Hello, and welcome to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. I'm Kelly Taylor. Today on the show is Erica Keswin. She's a workplace strategist. She's worked for the past 20 years with some of the most iconic brands in the world as a consultant, a speaker, and what she calls a professional dot connector. Most recently, she wrote a book called Bring Your Human to Work, 10 Surefire Ways to Design a Workplace That's Good for People, Great for Business, and Just Might Change the World. I love this book. In today's culture of constant connectivity, it's hard to know when to turn off from work. You know, a lot of times you can work day and night and just really burn out. This book is about bringing your, quote, human to work in so many different ways when it comes to meetings and how you approach meetings, you know, playing the long game, how companies treat parental leave and diversity, and as well as personal development in the workplace and so much more. The book is really helpful for managers, leaders in business, entrepreneurs, and it can also help anyone who's looking for a new job, you know, anyone who's working right now, just to figure out what they want in the workplace. So I hope you enjoy.
Okay, yeah. We're rolling. I love it. So if you talk to people that have known me my whole life, some of them actually live here in LA, and I'm seeing them this week. If you were to say to them, what's the one word you would use to describe Erica? Pretty much everybody would say the word connector. And I think I was just born to do it. I love connecting to saying, you know what, I want to connect you with this person just because I know you'll hit it off, or just because I know there'll be a great business opportunity. Nothing needs to come to me for that other than I get a tremendous amount of pleasure doing it. And right. So that's what I do. I go out there and I'm constantly connecting the dots, meaning connecting people. I worked in executive recruiting, connecting great people to great jobs. On the side, I've set up a few marriages. So, you know,
that's
pretty great too. And also connecting when I go into a company, I think one of my strengths also is hearing all the different issues that they're facing and pretty quickly being able to assess what are the themes, which is another way to connect the dots.
What are the themes? Got it.
You know, what are the themes that they're dealing with? And oftentimes, how do they relate to bring your human to work? And then what are some potential solutions with some issues that they might be having?
Gotcha. How did you come up with the title of the book?
So I live in New York, and I live on the Upper West Side, and every day I go to Starbucks. It's just my thing. I'm not a big meditator. My morning meditation is going in and getting my Grande Extra Hot Soy Latte.
Same.
And sitting there with the heat on my hands.
Mm-hmm.
And
with
I,
the app.
Well, no,
app.
But interestingly, you know, yes, now with the app, before, you know, I've been living in my apartment for 13 years, so many of those visits to Starbucks were pre-app. Mm. So I got to know my barista, Ashley Peterson, and Ashley would have my drink ready to go. She'd see me a block away, and again, before the app, she'd have it ready. I got to know her. She got to know my kids, and I had two kids when I first started going to the Starbucks. Then I had my son a couple years later. And a few years ago, my daughter Caroline became obsessed with the pumpkin scones at Starbucks. And if you're a Starbucks fan, you know that it's a big thing in the fall when the pumpkin spice lattes are launched and the pumpkin scones, you know, they don't have them all the time. So Ashley says to my daughter Caroline, now Caroline, I want you to know that in a few weeks after Halloween into November, the pumpkin scones will be gone. And Caroline was bummed, but she was like, okay. So a couple weeks later, it's now the middle of November. Ashley sees me. She gives me my latte. We continue walking to school. There's no more pumpkin scones. And all of a sudden, I hear someone screaming my name running down Broadway, you know, Manhattan, 7:30 a.m., not a pretty regular thing that one
might.
Yeah, Erica! And I'm like, what the heck? And it's funny that you asked about the app, because in that moment when Ashley was chasing me down the street, I thought I had left my wallet at Starbucks because it was before the app. So I turn around, there's no wallet, it's Ashley, and she's chasing me. She's out of breath. She catches up, and she says to Caroline, now, Caroline, I know you're really bummed, no more scones, but now that it's November and it's holiday season here at Starbucks, we now have this great piece of gingerbread, and maybe this is something that you would like. So it wasn't just this big, huge smile on Caroline's face, But being a workplace strategist and working with companies for 20 plus years and helping them improve performance through people, this was this aha moment for me. I had known Ashley at this point for probably 6 years, and this was a person I had this relationship with behind the counter. She came out of the counter, behind the counter, literally chasing me down the street. And in that moment, two things happened. One, this idea about bringing, like, I'm like, wow, she brought her human to work. And I literally remember saying that in my head, because all of a sudden there she was physically in front of me. So literally she did it. But the second thing was, from a workplace strategist perspective, I thought to myself, wow, if Starbucks or any company could bottle what Ashley just did in this moment, especially in this age of this digital revolution where we're constantly now communicating much more via technology, if these companies could bottle this, we could crack the code on any business. And just as an aside, the good news for Ashley is that Starbucks noticed this. It wasn't just me. She's been promoted, I think, 5 times since then, and now she manages her very own Starbucks.
Yeah, there was actually a point in your book where she wrote a really touching letter to the CEO of Starbucks, like when you were going to an event that he was at, which I was like, oh, Ashley.
I mean, she's the most amazing. Like, when you meet her, and she came to my book launch in New York a couple of weeks ago, where Katie Couric interviewed me, and Ashley was there, and Katie asked me, you know, what was the inspiration for the book, and I told the story, and I said, and Ashley's here, and Ashley stood up, and then the craziest thing happened. There was, you know, many times when you're at a Starbucks or, you know, a place like that, and you go every day, it is a community, and the same people are often there every single day. And so you get, right? I don't know if the one you go to, but I'm now, you know, I'm visiting in LA and I've seen the same people every morning, even at the one across the street from my hotel. So a woman who was at the book launch walked up to Ashley, and Ashley hasn't worked on the Upper West Side now for 5 or 6 years. And this woman, Barbara, went up to her and said, Ashley, do you remember me? What's my drink? And this has been 5 years. And Ashley said, oh, skinny vanilla latte or something. And then, you know, the woman started crying. Like, oh, my gosh. Like, just when people have that human touch and remember that. Again, I think especially in today's age when we feel we might have a million friends on Facebook, but we as a society feel, in general, pretty disconnected.
Totally. Yeah. You know, it's when I was reading that, I was thinking of the grocery store that I go to. There's three near me. And one in particular, Trader Joe's, the employees are always way more personable. And it makes me think, like, they must do some type of, like, analysis of one's personality when they're being hired.
They do. There's a lot. They're not in the book, but there's been a lot. It's great. It's great that you notice that without even knowing what they do. Because clearly what they're doing is working. It stands out. Just like when I put JetBlue in the book, you fly on JetBlue and something feels different. So yeah, you should check it out. They do a lot of work around the culture at Trader Joe's. Uh-huh. Amazing programs and perks and policies that keep people there. And they are very committed to working at Trader Joe's. And it shows.
You can totally tell. They just seem like kind of excited to be there. Compared to other, you know, places I've been grocery shopping, and also interested in what you're buying, and, oh, how do you cook this? Oh, I even tried this, or, oh, you know what, I love to throw this, heat it up just for, you know, 10 seconds in the microwave, it's great, you gotta try it. That just happens every time that I'm like, Trader Joe's, you're killing it. It's all about, I feel like...
They're bringing their human to work.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, definitely. Okay, so before we get into, I wrote down actually some takeaways from the book that I'd love to just like go over, but I'm curious if like in your work experience over the years, what were like the major differences that you've noticed in generations and what they want at their workplace? Like between, let's say, baby boomers, Gen X, millennials, and then maybe even the younger one.
Yeah, Gen Z. They're there now. It's amazing. Some companies have 4 to 5. McDonald's was on a podcast once that said they even have 6 generations of people working in the same company. Very different people, very different needs, but also some similarities. So when we started hearing more and more about purpose and wanting meaning at work, a lot of those ideas are associated with millennials. Uh-huh. And I believe millennials are bringing great things to the workplace. You know, you see many eye rolls, you see people complaining. They're very clear about what they want. And the reason why this has become a big part of people's conversation is that millennials will represent 75% of the workforce by 2025 and 50% by 2020, which is literally right around the corner.
Yeah.
You know, be here before you know it. So companies have really started to think about how can we connect people to greater purpose and meaning at work. But what a lot of people don't know, because these ideas are so closely related to millennials, is that the desire for purpose and meaning at work, it actually increases with age. So as different as these generations are, when you really go down to the core, you know, of everyone's a human being, there are more similarities than you might think. The difference was for the Gen Xers and the baby boomers, there weren't enough of, you know, I'm a Gen Xer, there weren't enough of us to sort of move the needle, especially working women at that time, on some of these issues. And right. The baby boomers, it was like, work is work. Mm-hmm. You know, we shouldn't be happy at work. Like, we're going to work, and then we're going to come home and be able to be ourselves at home. And my own personal theory on some of this and the change is that, you know, because we used to come home and work stayed at work, and now that it doesn't anymore, much of that due to technology, there's this shift in saying, well, if all the work is coming home with me in many ways, even if you're good at turning your phone off, it doesn't go away anymore. I need to be able to figure out ways to bring more of myself, to have flexibility, to take care of some personal things, to have more purpose and meaning at work, have more purpose and meaning at work, because the separation doesn't exist. So to answer your questions, yeah, there are some unique things about these different generations, but there are more similarities than people typically talk about.
Totally. Yeah. When you think about how the connectivity has increased with time, it's so hard for people to, like, let's say you're provided a cell phone, you're provided a laptop, and then you go home. It's like there's pressure to, well, I got to answer these emails. Like, if it's here, I got to stay connected. Or if, you know, a client calls you at night, there's obviously pressure to keep up with that. So, yes, I could see where you would maybe strive for more happiness when the lines are muddled in those places.
Yeah.
Actually, the chapter about disconnect to reconnect, I feel like probably resonates with every single person who talks about it and thinks about it and reads about it. Because, like, there was some statistic that you said, 1/3 of Americans would rather give up sex for 3 months than their smartphone for 1 week, which is incredible. And I have to say, do you have an iPhone?
I do.
The screen time feature is so scary. It's amazing, because I'm like, thank you for presenting me with this information, but I'm also like ashamed to be confronted with it, how much you're on it.
I know. I just upgraded my phone, and it is a shock.
Yeah.
And what happens is we need to create protocols or types of discipline to save us from ourselves. And this is sort of cheesy, but it resonates, which is, left to our own devices, we're not connecting with people on a higher level. So whether it's at home with your family or with your friends, trying to, you know, everything from let's go to dinner and put our phones in the middle and the first one that reaches for the phone pays, or the manager at work saying, okay, we're having this meeting and the data clearly shows that when your phones are out, the topics are less substantive and the meetings are longer, which leads to less productivity. So it really is a lose-lose that the technology's out. So it's trying to create these rules of the road, whether it's in our personal life or our professional life. And one of the images that I often see in my mind after traveling around the country talking to hundreds and hundreds of people about this is this image of the sheriff, because this is the Wild West. The iPhone is only 10 years. Last summer was the 10-year anniversary. And so we're figuring this out on a personal level, but also in our companies.
Oh, yeah, totally. And just as far as, like, when you're talking about being in a meeting and sitting on your phone, I was just in a meeting a couple hours ago, and having read this book, I'm like way more attentive to it too, because it is like, it's a huge waste of time. If you're not actively engaged in what this meeting is about and you're just sitting on your phone, then yeah, we could have just sent this in an email or something. I mean, what's the point of being there?
Right. Well, when the story about Ashley was the inspiration for the book, I'll share a story which told me I have to write the book now. which was I spoke to a CEO who shared with me that there was a conference call in his company, and he found out after the fact that all nine people had called into the call from the same building. All nine. So in other words, they were an elevator bank, a couple of steps, a cubicle away from each other. And when I heard this story, I know there's always a person or two that have to call in if they're on the road. I'm like, wow, they were all in the same building. And I said to myself, you know, what would make someone decide to forego the opportunity to connect with their colleagues face to face? And it was in that moment that I thought, you know what, I need to write this book now, and I need to look at why people are doing that, A, and B, what is the impact to us as individuals, but also to our businesses? Because if I can build that business case, I can hopefully begin to convince people why there's a huge upside to actually walking down the hall instead of calling in, you know, to a meeting down the hall.
Right. So there's benefits to, even though you might have a lot of work to do, so you're going to sit at your desk and be on the call and kind of half pay attention and do work.
Multitasking is not a real thing. It doesn't work. And every task you add degrades the quality of your work by 20%. And so, and then we've all been on those meetings where someone says, hey, Erica, what did you think about that? And I say, wait, what?
Yeah.
And then everyone knows what you were doing. And so it not only is less productive because somebody has to repeat something, but it also does hurt relationships.
Yeah, that's honestly the worst, to get called out and you weren't paying attention. So one thing I was thinking about is whenever I go on vacation, let's say, and it's like the last day of vacation, I tend to log into my email just to check it so that the first day back, I'm not overwhelmed with it. What do you do when you're like, let's say on vacation, not traveling for work, you're just like with your family? Do you check email? And what do you kind of tell people in that situation?
So I do a couple of things. Number one, I'll change my out of office so that people, you know, once you start emailing with people, there's this certain, everybody has their own general response time. Yeah. And so when you're on vacation, that response time will likely change. So I'll put something on my out of office. You know, I'm going to be much slower to get back to you. If you need somebody immediately, call this person. Or I might say, you know, when I've been on trips where I literally can't, you know, in the middle of nowhere where there's virtually no cell service, and I'll say I won't be on at all for a couple of days.
Right.
I would say if I'm on a regular vacation, I often will check, because to your point, I find it actually reduces my stress. I can forward things that are mission critical. But I, you know, back to this idea of creating protocols and discipline, we were on one vacation with my kids, and I remember I took all of our phones and I locked them in the safe. And I'm like, all right, no one's going to be on their phones for the next 4 hours. So I don't think we need to put pressure on ourselves to have a full unplugged vacation unless that's something that you really want. You know, figure out what works for you and that's the right approach.
Yeah, to what's manageable for how you work, what's will stress you out the least.
Yeah. I guess. Although this was really interesting. So I taped I was on Sirius XM yesterday with Maria Menounos, and she said that there were some people, let's say, that work for her, and she's like, go take a vacation. But her employees are on vacation. She sees them online all the time. And her worry is that if she doesn't figure out a way to shut it down, A, it could backfire and they could end up blaming her for their stress, even though she doesn't want them on anyway. She said she actually has gone into some people that work for her. Like, she'll go into their accounts and change the passwords so they're locked out, forcing them to actually take vacation.
Wow. There was someone you mentioned in the book, I think it may have been Huffington Post, that had a system in place to where their emails are deleted, or basically they say to the sender, hey, reach out when they're back.
Which is amazing. Yeah, Daimler has it, Huffington Post has it, which is great, because, you know, one of the reasons why you probably check your email, like you said, when you're away, is that you don't want to come back to 7,000 emails. Mm-hmm. And so there is a tool that a company can get, and it automatically, you press the button and you connect it, automatically deletes your emails, and you say, I'm not going to get these. Please resend it on, you know, Monday the 8th when I'm back. And then you know that for the most part, they will have either figured it out, or if it's really critical, they'll resend it. And if your company doesn't have something like that, you could actually do it You could put something in there yourself. I'm on vacation. I'm not going to see these emails. Please resend what you were going to send in a week.
When I'm back.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. There was another thing that...
What about Zmail?
Oh, wait. Yes. What's that?
So Vynamic is a healthcare consulting firm, and I profile them. I do a deep dive on them in the Be Well section of the book. And it's a consulting firm, and many consulting firms, you know, you even gave the example of, you know, if your client emails you at 9 o'clock at night, you feel even more that you have to respond. And so Dan Calista, the CEO, left one of the bigger consulting firms, and his feeling was there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a more humane way to set up a business like that. And his goal when he set it up was that he wanted it to be one of the healthiest companies in the world. And so he instituted this program called Zmail, as in catch some Z's, that he wants people to be able to sleep or do something other than work. And so their office protocol is that you can't send an email after 10 p.m. or before 6 a.m. or on weekends unless it's mission critical. And my favorite part of the program is that he will say, you don't want to be that person who sends the Z-bomb, which is the email at 9:55. And so it's just raising a level of awareness that it, you know, it might be great for you to send the email at 10 o'clock at night, but the person that you're sending it to, you know, might be out on a date or out to dinner or putting their kids to bed, whatever it is. And if it's not mission critical, why do you need to do it?
Totally. And depending on the contents of the email, it could totally change your mood.
100%. When it didn't have to. Mm-hmm. And all the people in this company, they are really hard workers. So it's not, there's no laziness thing in there. It's just saying, we know we're going to have to work some weekends and some nights, but let's be more thoughtful about doing it when we need to do it. Great, we're all in, but let's not send these emails unless we have to, because to your point, like, why ruin someone's night if you don't need to?
Totally. Yeah, that's smart. I remember I was going to bring up one of the CEOs that I think you spotlight in the book doesn't check her phone or email during the workday. Instead, it gets sent to her assistant, and the whole company knows, like, she doesn't check it because she wants to dedicate more time to her face-to-face interaction with
her employees. It's the head of HR at Unilever.
Oh, there we go.
Lena Nair. Yeah, and she's walking the walk. I want to, during the working hours, I want to connect with people.
Yeah, that is like a hard boundary that she set. I was like really impressed by that. And I was also thinking of like, wow, I want her assistant must be really good at delegating.
Well, I'm sure if she has, I'm sure they have their own protocol set up that if there's an emergency, the assistant calls her.
Yeah.
And then they deal with it. But this whole idea of, you know, even a woman that I spoke to at Google one time said that she just, even just, you don't necessarily need the Dan Calista program. If you're a manager, say to your team, and this is a true story from a woman at Google who said to her team, okay, guys, I just want you to know, I have 3 kids. From 6 to 9, I'm not on my email. If you need me, send me a text, call me, which they hardly ever did, but I'm not on email. But even more important, she then said to her team, I'm a night owl. At 10 o'clock, I am back on from probably 10 to 11:30 or 12. But you all know, unless you've heard from me ahead of time, you don't need to check it. And so just, again, being clear and thoughtful and intentional to help people disconnect. Mm-hmm. Or they won't. Or the default is they won't.
Yeah. And then they'll be just working all the time and burnout.
And then quit.
Yeah, totally.
And turnover is very expensive.
I think I watched an interview and Shonda Rhimes was talking about that same thing. She totally disengages, I think, once she's home with her family, which I remember thinking, this is a couple years ago, and I remember thinking, like, wow, that's super impressive, because she's obviously has so many different shows going on, has a lot of people that, you know, think they need an answer from her, but she's like, no, you can figure it out. If it's critical, then maybe, but no, I have, you know, I'm shutting it off. I love the idea of how you talk about playing the long game, and a lot of the points that you talk about in the book, I didn't even really think about. But then as you're bringing each different thing up, I'm like, yeah, what the heck? Companies should do that. And first, that we always talk about here is parental leave. And I didn't even know that, like, our federal law is just maternity leave unpaid for 12 weeks. Unpaid. That's like the only law that we have established in the United States. So obviously some companies go above that and will offer paid leave for moms, some for both moms and dads, for, you know, if you have a baby or if you adopt a baby. What are some companies that you found really go above and beyond with that? I know that you mentioned Patagonia, which has
they have on-site daycare.
Yeah.
You know, which is amazing. Well, let me just take a step back for people that didn't read the book to you know, what does it even mean playing the long game?
Yeah.
Because when I think of that chapter focuses on, you know, first diversity and inclusion, which is we know the data is clear that when we have a more diverse workforce, it is better for business. But how do we do that? And I think that's where a lot of companies get stuck. Where I took this chapter, which I think is a little different, which is linking it to this idea of what I call intentional work practices. Mm-hmm. Intentional meaning, if you don't create programs and policies to allow people to work flexibly and figure out how to get, you know, to be able to go to the doctor or to be able to vote mm-hmm. on Tuesday, which mm-hmm. we can talk about. There's some very cool things going on around with CEOs closing down their companies to make sure people can vote next week. Parental leave, bereavement leave. I mean, when Sheryl Sandberg's husband died at, you know, in his mid, you know, early 40s, or maybe he was just 40, unexpectedly, and she's at Facebook, you know, a company that has unbelievable programs and perks and things like this. She couldn't even believe that they, you know, she didn't even think that it was that great when someone has a person that dies in their life, whether it's a husband or a parent or a child, and has moved to, she then doubled, I think, the days that they gave at Facebook and is lobbying other companies, like MasterCard is one that just increased theirs. So in a broader context, it's this idea of how can we make work more sustainable, more human for all kinds of people? Because if we don't, you know, if we don't do that, how are we ever going to attract and retain women who are the ones that are giving birth to children if you want them to come back? So that's sort of the broader context. In terms of who's doing some interesting things, you know, we talked about Patagonia. It's unbelievable. I visited. There's kids running around all over. How cool for men and women to be able to bring your kid, you know, to school, let alone the money that you're saving on childcare, which is unbelievable. There's a, on the other end of the spectrum, there's a company called The Muse, which has not been around for many years, like Patagonia. They have a program, it's called Bring Your Baby to Work, and they have something called a baby squad. So you can bring your baby to work for the first 6 months or when the baby starts crawling, that's kind of where it ends because it's a little tricky.
Yeah.
But they invite you to bring the baby to work. You create a sort of a friend group in your company of people that get some training on how to care for a kid or people that you know, so that if you have a meeting that you can't bring your baby to, you can give the baby to somebody to watch. Mm-hmm. But other than that, you can bring your baby to work for the first 6 months, which not only has unbelievable benefits for the baby, but lowering the stress for the mother. And it's, you know, so unbelievable. In terms of parental leave, more and more companies are giving it, you know, it's not just maternity leave, they're giving it to men. A few of the two really progressive examples that I can share, this is just in the last 6 months even, or a year. One is Microsoft, which when we talk about making exponential change in some of these areas. Microsoft, a month ago, announced that they were only going to work with suppliers that give 12 or 16 weeks of parental leave, which is a huge statement. I mean, if you're Microsoft, imagine how many suppliers every week that you work with, and they're saying, you know what, we're not only focusing on within the thousands and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that work at Microsoft. We're now taking this, and I talk about it in the book as the supply, you know, enlightened supply chain. Mm-hmm. We're going to look down our supply chain and try to get the companies that we partner with to also bring their human to work.
Yeah, that's great, because obviously, like, it might be, you know, it's the long game, because it'll be a cost, but in the end, then you end up hopefully keeping like a good talent in your workforce, mm-hmm. like keeping someone around who, you know, feels comfortable, feels respected, feels like they can manage, you know, whatever's going on in their life and being there.
Mm-hmm. Another example you might find interesting is this company. There's been this debate on, should we make parental leave for, especially for the men, mandatory? Mm-hmm. Because if parental leave continues to always be an issue that women take it and men don't, does that lead to not helping move the dial on fixing that inequality in the workplace? Because it's a women's thing. And if you're a hiring manager and you're hiring a woman who's 28 and you're thinking ahead, well, she's probably going to have a kid, maybe two, maybe three. I'm going to hire the guy. And so there are some companies that are now making it mandatory so that it's not an equality issue. And because the data show, you know, it's the gift that you're giving the father and the child to be able to have some, you know, concentrated time together in the early, you know, stages of that child's life.
Definitely. You have a couple children,
I
right?
have three kids, yeah.
For you personally, when did you feel like you were able, after having your children, going back to work, like, was there a certain amount of time where you were like, you feel like it's too early, or sort of, okay, I'm itching to get back to work, or, you know, like, what was that for you, that time frame?
Well, for me, I had kids. I had my twins at 34, so aww. New York, that might be so not so old, but, you know, in the rest of the world, that's a little on the older side, I guess. And it was twins, and I'm only 5'2", so I needed some extra time to even recover from that pregnancy. I went back after 10 months, so I took 10 months off, and my company was amazing. I'd worked there for a long time, and they said, you can come back in any way, shape, or form that you want, which was amazing. It's also a sign of the times, because I'm laughing even thinking about this now, is that I went back and I loved it, but I was in a job, and this is, so this was 2000, they were born in 2003, so this is, you know, now 2004, and yeah, we were using technology, but not in the way we were using it now. So I remember I went back, and I just decided that it was because of the nature of that job that I felt like I could never turn it off. It was very client-facing. Mm. And I ended up leaving and going to do something else that was not client-facing. But it's funny thinking about our earlier conversation, which is, if it was now, every job, you can't turn off any job. But back then, there was still this perception / reality that there were some jobs that you can turn off. And I had decided, with two young kids, I wanted to have something that was more likely to turn off at the end of the day. Right. And now my kids are, look, now my kids are older. They're, you know, they're all teenagers. They're not thrilled with me being on this book tour, but they know how hard I worked on it. And I also think for my two daughters, it's nice for them to see their mom also being the one out there doing some of this.
Totally. Power woman.
Yeah.
There's actually a Power Woman Summit in Los Angeles this weekend. We just had someone on talking about it, and it's like kind of...
Oh, the rap
yes,
women, yeah.
Exactly that, yeah. Which I think it's the first one ever.
Yeah, the big one, yeah. They do regional things, but this is the big one with everybody coming together.
Yeah, it sounded pretty interesting. There was like, who was it? The founder of the rap was on our show this morning, and I think like Rosanna Arquette. Let's talk about taking professional development personally, which is chapter 9 in your book. I love this. You write, strong human, personal, and professional development is now an absolute must-have. And the more that I read through this, the more I understood it. Like, I'm like, what do you mean develop personally? Because I think of like companies sort of saying, okay, we're going to help you grow professionally. Like, what do you want in a career? Sort of in that way. Mm-hmm. But also a lot of companies are taking the opportunity to bring in like a jewelry maker, or just sort of getting the minds racing on things outside of even what your company is doing, which is really cool. Do you feel like a lot of companies embrace this? Like, when you were going through and doing your research, did you find a lot of companies were sort of doing this, or is this something that way more companies need to get on
moving,
board with?
Companies are starting to think more about this, and it goes back to the numbers that I shared about the millennials. You know, there's so many of them, and when you think about the top three things that they want / demand, and they're not as much driven by the salary, so they'll leave if they don't get it, which in a tight job market like we have today, attracting and retaining talent is a top priority of most companies. So what do they want? They want purpose and meaning, they want flexibility in how they work, which is in chapter 2, playing the long game, and they want to grow on the job. And so it's, you know, I wouldn't say everybody's there yet, but they're realizing that they have to be more creative about how they develop people. And I think part of that is, you know, back in the day, you know, think of a GE or an IBM, you know, there were a million rungs in the ladder, you know, and then I'm going to go to here and then I'm going to get promoted to here. Organizations are flat now, so we can't always keep promoting people up. So we need to get more creative about moving people up, down, and across and letting them develop in ways that are interesting to them. So the first concept in taking professional development personally is even asking people, you know, what are you interested in learning? And trying to find ways to match that. And oftentimes it costs nothing. So I profile a company, not-for-profit, dosomething.org, in the book. It's run by Aria Finger, and she's a total rock star. And, you know, this example, they have 70 people or 65 people, which is very different than a company that has, you know, 20,000 people. But from a conceptual standpoint, you know, she talks to each person or has her top people connect with everybody and say, you know, what, how do you want to grow and develop other than the technical skills that you need to do your job better? Do you want to be a better public speaker? Do you want to, you know, be able, do you want to write, have a byline in an article? And so she creates this list, and then she hears about interesting opportunities and she's able to match them. And it costs nothing. It's helping the person that's looking for someone to, you know, that has a need, and it's helping the people, and they feel like they've been heard and they're developing skills that are important to them.
Totally. Yeah, just like taking on a new skill and doing something you didn't even think you could do. I'm literally just thinking of me doing this podcast because this isn't my sole job here.
Right.
But learning how to do the soundboard and how to even like do post-production on audio. Like just doing new skills, there's like dopamine in your brain.
Yes.
That's like, oh yes, I could do this. And it just like boosts morale, I think, in general.
Yes.
Yeah.
100%. And so, you know, in general, but then also for you, you know, you've been here for 4+ years and you have so much institutional knowledge and you're an employee they don't want to lose.
Yeah.
Because that institutional knowledge goes out the door with you. And so to give you these growth opportunities, it's good for you and it's smart for them from a business perspective.
Totally. Do you watch The Office?
I do.
This, for some reason, this reminded me of the Finer Things Club, which Pam and Oscar and Toby, for anyone who watches The Office, they get together and chat about like arts and books in kind of a civilized manner. It's like their interest that they gather and meet in the break room and talk about it. And I was just thinking of, like, you mentioned how a lot of employees have hobbies outside of work that they could bring to the table. Like they could teach other employees like, oh, you know what, let's talk about I'm going to teach you all how to crochet or, you know, whatever you could think of. There is a lot of that that is free, you know.
Yeah. And companies are now doing it. They're collecting, you know, what can you teach the group? And when you actually get up there and teach something, you're building your skills on presenting.
Yeah.
And what better way to get better at whatever it is by teaching it to someone else. And to your point, it's free. And so a lot of companies now are, you know, collecting this sort of internal professional development, and taking it personally means even something different in that context, because the personal part is you up there, you know, sharing your knowledge. And it's, people seem to love it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think about and talk about a lot, going back to the left to your own devices, we're not connecting, is that we need to curate connection. And, you know, before all this technology was so prevalent, you could have a happy hour and people would come and everybody would chat because you weren't being pulled onto your phones.
Right.
Now you have, let's say, a happy hour and you have a group of people that don't come. Maybe they have too many emails and they'd rather get to inbox zero. You have a group of people that do come. Maybe they're introverted. Maybe they just don't feel like dealing and they're going through the motions. They feel like they have to come, but they're kind of in the corner on their phones. And so the company spends money and everybody gives time, but nothing's really happening. And you don't walk out of there with that hit of dopamine or that oxytocin rush. And so whether it's through creating cool professional development opportunities, or there's a company that I mentioned in the book called Zendesk, which turns the tables, and at their quarterly happy hour, they have all the senior leaders, the bosses, making the drinks, which is just funny and they don't know what they're doing. And it creates these opportunities for laughter and for conversations, or a financial services company in New York that brings in, you know, picture a Katie Couric type, you know, fun, spunky interviewer who's interviewing the boss in front of all the associates about, you know, what was the worst experience you ever had at work? And did you have a pet? And trying to humanize the boss. So the next time people see the person in the elevator, they're much more likely to look up and say hello. So yeah. Professional development's a piece of that, but I think this whole idea that we know connection is good for business because it increases productivity, innovation, and for people in a society where the Surgeon General says that the biggest health risk facing our country is not smoking or secondhand smoke, it's actually loneliness and isolation, we need to feel and figure out how we can be more connected at work.
Yeah. Wow, totally. More dangerous than smoking is, that's intense.
It is. They say that, I put on my Instagram, I had this scary, with the Halloween theme, scary stat of the day, which is loneliness has the same impact on our health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Wow. Yeah, we're social people, us human beings.
Right. We are born for that. And which is why depression is up and, you know, all these depressing things. Yeah.
Totally. You know, and you talking about like just sort of these things that you can bring into the workplace, to like bringing a Katie Couric type person in to interview the boss. It makes me think that Michael Scott, say what you will about him, but he was definitely on to something because they always perform the best and he did the most outrageous stuff like that.
Yeah.
There was one thing that I wanted to bring up. Oh. Meetings. Mm-hmm. Meetings on meetings, meetings about meetings, meetings all day long. There's something that you mentioned how I think an employee can spend like 23 hours a week in meetings, which is more than half of the work week if you work, you know, full time, 40 hours, which is insane to me. Mm-hmm. That did you find that to be like a common thread among a lot of companies?
Yes.
Like employees
were
like, too many meetings.
Well, and people in some companies, literally, you're spending every hour. They move from one meeting to another every hour. And then they say that they can't get their real work done until 5 o'clock.
Right.
And they don't want to work all night. And then people wonder why there's so much turnover.
Mm-hmm.
And so I break that chapter down into three things, which is purpose, presence, and protocols. I think if all of us could almost do this post-mortem and take a look at all the meetings you had last week and look at them, see who was there. What was the purpose of these meetings? Was there a purpose? Some people talk about how they have the 11 o'clock status meeting on Wednesday. Why do they have it? It's inertia. They've always had it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe we don't need to have it anymore. And so my guess is you could probably get rid of 20% of your meetings if you make sure that each meeting does have a true purpose. And then the second part goes back to some of what we were talking about earlier, which is we know that physical presence and psychological or mental presence are not the same thing. So if you're going to actually give the time, you've decided that your meeting has a purpose and you're going to have it, really have it and be present. And if you can figure out ways, you know, within the politics of your company to get everybody to get rid of the technology, the meetings will be shorter, more substantive. And the third part is that here we are talking about all these statistics about how people aren't connecting. What better time to actually connect as people is in these meetings?
Mm-hmm.
But we're wasting that if we're all multitasking. So get rid of it. Connect as people. In the technology companies, many of them have what they call standing meetings. And everybody just, you know, it started with the programmers and the coders, that they would all get together, talk about an issue that they were having, standing up, and then go back to their desks. You know, some companies will say to me, you know what, it's not a standing meeting, but we're going to actually only have a teeny little table in the room, because if you don't have the right table, how is everybody going to take out their laptop and kind of settle in for an hour meeting where they're all on their technology?
Yeah. And even the difference of your table setup, like if you're sitting at a round table versus like a long conference table, that can affect the flow of conversation. 100%. I love the example of, there's a couple examples of people who have an interesting approach to meetings in their companies. One is Netflix's VP of product, Todd Yellen.
Todd Yellen.
Which he says basically, listen, there's no tech allowed. Do not come with your phones. You know, anyone can come, but if you're coming, like, be prepared to contribute to the meeting.
Right, he has the no wallflower rule.
Yeah.
Because you can't just come and listen, and you certainly can't come without your technology. What I also like about Todd's approach is he also leverages technology to make sure people's voices are heard. So he sends out all the stuff ahead of time, wants everybody to read it. And because there's no technology, once you get to the meeting, you can't be flipping through your phone to quickly read what you were supposed to have read. Number two is there's a Google Doc that lays it all out. So if you can't be there in person, or if you could be there in person, but you don't really feel like being that active participant, and since he's not allowing the wallflowers, you can have your voice heard and weigh in on the Google Doc to get your thoughts in there. But, you know, he's very clear. The other thing he does is that we've all been in meetings where our part's done, and we're probably texting under the table when it's not our turn anymore. But if there's no technology, you're even more antsy. And all you want to do is get out of there so badly. But you feel that it's rude to get up in the middle of a meeting. What he says is it's actually worse to stay in a meeting that's not relevant for you, and it's not good for the company. So after every couple of agenda items, he has a break, and he's like, please leave if your part is done, or if you are now in a position where your time can be better spent somewhere else.
Yeah, I love that.
It's clear. Oh, and I will say, I wondered what the people thought that sit in the meeting. So I interviewed a few of them, and they love it. They love it. You know, it's almost like he's giving them the gift of being able to focus. And you know, because if no one makes us do it, it's almost like giving boundaries to your kids when, you know, they say they want to be able to stay out all night, but in the end they really want boundaries and feel like, you know, that's just good for them. And I feel like it's the same thing, that once Todd says, you know what, you want to come to the product meeting at Netflix, which, by the way, who wouldn't want to go to the product? I mean, I'd want to go to the product meeting at Netflix, and I'm happy to try to not be a wallflower. And so all of a sudden you're there and you don't have your phone because you're not allowed. And you're like, wow, I can actually think. I can actually have more depth to this hour. And it's so sad to me even just saying this out loud.
I know. Right? It sounds so silly to say, but it's 100% true.
Right. You're like, I can actually take the time to really think and process and connect the dots and all of that.
Yeah, and maybe is a testament to how their product is going.
Well, I mean, seriously, right, they are crushing it at Netflix.
Insane.
And he did say, one of the Netflix values is, I forget what they call it specifically, but he was so not about boasting about his approach to meetings that it was almost like downplaying it. But he did say that there were other leaders in the company that have adopted some of these strategies.
Got it. Good for him. Todd Yellen. I like that last name, too. I'm Yellen. I really like the... So chapter one is... I think you mentioned how, like, you put it at number one for a reason. And it's basically about, like, being real in every sense of the word. And when you think about it as a company, instead of, like, you know, just an individual person, but as a company that, I guess, pertains to their values and then implementing, like, how do those values actually happen amongst the employees? And there was some really good examples. JetBlue seems like they're killing it in every way. They just seem like a really fun company to work for. Mm-hmm. And one of the examples that I remember was two employees had been flying, and afterward they were going to the hotel and got into a car accident. And JetBlue actually put some crew in a car to drive to the hotel and just make sure they were okay. Mm-hmm. And that was just like something the company did. There's another example of Lyft, probably multiple examples of Lyft, but the one that I'm thinking of is, it was Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. And a passenger got into the Lyft driver's car, and they're all about, like, you know, sit in the front seat. We want to connect with each other. Right. We want to uplift each other.
They have four very clear values. One of them is uplift others.
Uplift others. So this passenger gets into the car, and it's Valentine's Day. The Lyft driver hands her a Valentine's Day card. And for whatever reason, that particular day, it really hit her, and she started crying. So the Lyft driver pulls over, turns the meter off. They chat, you know, they probably work through what's going on with her. Just, you know, he or she lends an ear and drop him off. It's done. No, you know, no sweat, whatever. Later, the company learns that this person was contemplating suicide, and this driver just happened to be like the person to chat with them and potentially, you know, really changed the course of their life.
100%.
Which is incredible. And it's not something that you could, you know, obviously put in the handbook and say, listen, you gotta hand out Valentines to each of your passengers and, you know, talk them off a ledge. But it's that to me seems like the hardest thing to really do, especially if you have a big company, you know, and JetBlue obviously is doing it, but it seems like something that's really like, the idea is amazing. It seems like hard to really implement.
Right? In practice.
Yeah.
Right. So what I would say is, you know, people will ask, you know, what order are the chapters in, and, you know, how'd you come up? Why are there 10? And I say, you know, people who read the book can pick and choose from a menu of options. Which ideas are they having? They want to start with issues around diversity and inclusion, start with chapter 2. If they're hearing all their people say that they need to be developed more, go to chapter 9. Mm-hmm. Except for chapter 1, and to what you just said, I mean, chapter 1 is first for a reason, and it's called Be Real, How to Speak in an Authentic Voice. And it's about, there's three parts to it. Know your values. And one mistake that a lot of companies make is that they have way too many values, 10, 12, 14 values. And one of the reasons, you know, from my professional perspective, the sweet spot is 4 to 6 values. You know, if you have 14 values and you walk around an office, who on earth is going to remember 14 values, number one? Number two, how are they going to, you know, forgetting the Lyft pun, you know, how are they going to drive any kind of behavior? And so the litmus test that I use is, you know, are your values, if you are at a fork in the road, you know, it's called the fork in the road litmus test, and you're trying to decide, should I hire this person? Should I fire this person? Should I do this deal? Should I launch this new product? You know, what do your values say about mm-hmm. that decision? And if they're not informing it in any way, shape, or form, then the values may be wrong. You might have too many. They might not be working for you. So I include Lyft because, as you said, I mean, they have four very clear values, uplift others being one of them. And what companies can do and to help, I mean, like you said, this is hard. It's not rocket science at all. But to do this in practice takes discipline, intention, and a lot of work. But what JetBlue does and what Lyft does is that they identify these values, they empower people to live them, and then when they identify people who are living them, they share them in a variety of ways. Lyft in particular does it through storytelling. So the story that you recalled from the book, which I'm so excited you remembered that story, it's really very powerful, is that when the CEO, Logan Green, got an email from the friend of that passenger who said, you know, told him the story and said, by the way, this driver, you know, changed the trajectory of my friend's life, Logan Green could have been like, that's great, wow, amazing, but kept it to himself. Mm-hmm. Instead, once a month at Lyft's all-hands meetings, they celebrate and recognize one driver, sort of a front of the office employee and then a back office employee, of how they've lived one of the four values. So the month that happened, and when Logan Green found out that story, that was the one story that they shared with the whole company. So everyone in that company got uplifted as well.
Yeah, I can see where that would, if I heard that just in my day, I would be like, wow. I mean, just because something like as a Lyft driver, you're interacting with people all the time. And, you know, what you say can, I've been in so many Ubers and Lyfts where like, I had a great conversation just with the person I wasn't even expecting to. And then when I got out, I was like, wow, that was a great ride.
Human interaction. That reminds me of something that happened 2 days ago. I've been visiting companies while I've been in LA, and you live in LA, so you know there's a lot of traffic in LA. And so I was working with this group of people about being more intentional about connecting. It's a consulting firm, so a lot of times when they're out of the office, they're on client sites, and then when they're not with their clients, sometimes they're allowed to work from anywhere. And one of the women said, yeah, it's a pain, and I have to pay, you know, $20 for my ride to come into the office, and sometimes I'd rather work from home. She said, but on the days when I make the trip and come in and connect with my other colleagues, I'm just happier on the way home. And I know I've had to deal with the traffic and deal with the commuting. And so what the groups were talking about was, especially, you know, in a place like LA, was strategizing and saying, okay, we know we like it when we see each other, We like the flexibility to work from Starbucks or work from home, mm-hmm. but we know that something shifts in our, you know, physical and mental being when we actually connect with each other. We actually like each other, and we talk about clients and, you know, think we get creative ideas. And they said, all right, well, let's try to coordinate. So this particular group said on Sunday, sometimes the Friday before the next week or sometimes Sunday, they all start communicating about which days can they all decide that they'll come into the office so that when they do come in, they'll all actually be there versus somebody coming in and then walking around and having nobody there.
Right.
So you want that. It's a challenge because you want that flexibility, like we talked about earlier. But we know that, you know, good things happen when people connect.
Yeah, totally. I know you got to get out of here, but I feel like this book is, first of all, it was an easy read for me, which it's like, I don't know. I think that it's great for someone who's maybe thinking of starting a business, any entrepreneur, someone who's in a manager setting. But also, I think it's great for if you're thinking about, you know, applying to a certain job or if you're thinking about getting a job, making a move in your career. It helps you kind of understand, like, what am I looking for? You know what I mean?
I'm so glad you raised that. You know, I wrote this book originally from the perspective of a leader creating a more human team, department, division, or even a CEO looking at the whole company. But interestingly, my editor, McGraw-Hill, who's an older millennial, when she read the proposal, she said, you know what, if we flip this, these are the 10 things that people want in a company. So mm-hmm. you're absolutely right that if someone to look at this, and you can't have all of it at the same time, but it can help you prioritize and say, do I want a company that's really living the values? Is professional development the most important? Do I want to make sure that there's strong parental leave? You know, yeah. And so it is really a way for anyone looking for a job to vet which companies might be a better fit for them.
Totally. And even like when I was reading some of these examples, I was thinking in my mind, oh, my company does this and it makes me appreciate it more. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, I hope that I would love for every company to go, and I would love to, of course, do this with them, but to go through this exercise mm-hmm. of mapping what programs they have to these 10 things, see which ones they do the most strongly, and where are the gaps? Because yeah. It's a great tool for internal marketing to say, you know what, we do these things and you should stay. It's great for recruiting in new people.
Yeah.
And it gives you an idea of sort of how you stack up and where you want to invest, you know, to do better.
Yeah. Erica, thank you. I enjoyed reading this book a lot.
I'm so glad.
I really did. I was like texting my sister. I'm like, what are your company's values? Do you feel like they... She emailed them to me.
Oh,
she was like, tell me if you think.
Me.
I know.
I'm collecting all the company's values. There's some really fun... Like sometimes companies have... I'm collecting a list of my favorite sort of fun company values. So uh-huh. General Assembly is in the book. And one of their values is use all the parts of the buffalo. Like, don't waste anything.
Yeah.
Right? It's just
get
so
the fur,
fun,
get the, yeah.
and you can just see, you know, what that means. IBM, I was there recently, they had something about these wild ducks. And so I'm just creating these lists of, mm-hmm. of values, and it's great.
Totally. Well, thank you. And we'll, of course, like link your book in the show notes, and ericacaswin.com is your website with
Correct.
All your
yep.
social media and stuff. Cool.
Great.
Well, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you for having me.
Very good. Thank you for listening to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. If you enjoyed the show, we'd love for you to share it with a friend. You know, share it with someone you know, someone who might get a lot out of this. Don't forget, you can also purchase Erica's book, Bring Your Human to Work, wherever you buy books. It's on Amazon, all those good places. And if you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe to our podcast, Olympic and Bundy, wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have an iPhone, we're on Apple Podcasts, we're on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, CastBox, you know, all the things. Once again, I'm Kelly Taylor, and thank you very much for listening.